It's 6 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting at least 5 people are dead, dozens injured Wednesday after a car plowed into pedestrians close to London's Parliament building. A policeman was stabbed to death before the assailant was shot and killed. Police describe it as a marauding terrorist attack. Mark Rowley heads the counter-terror policing. A massive investigation is underway.
We have hundreds of officers on this investigation, and they're focusing on the suspect's motivation, preparation, and his associates.
Rowley said as the vehicle was driven over Westminster Bridge, it struck pedestrians before crashing into Parliament. A knife-wielding man emerged, attempting to enter Parliament, but was confronted by the police. Rowley said security has been increased.
As a precautionary measure, over the next few days, we've increased the number of officers on duty, armed and unarmed, to provide a highly visible, reassuring presence.
Prime Minister Theresa May condemned the attack as sick and depraved and raised the threat level.
The United Kingdom's threat level has been set at severe for some time, and this will not change.
The attack coincided with the first anniversary of 2 suicide attacks in Brussels that left more than 30 dead and was claimed by Islamic State. The International Red Cross and Red Crescent Society has appealed for hundreds of millions in aid to help vast populations that face famine in 4 countries, Somalia, Yemen, South Sudan, and Nigeria. Regional official Dominic Stillhart called for a massive scale-up in assistance.
20 million people facing starvation is not something that we are dealing with every day, and therefore we really need to act now. And if we act now, especially in Yemen and in Somalia, famine can be averted.
He said there is a window of some 3 months during which large amounts of assistance must be distributed to counter the effects of drought and war. This is VOA News. As Syrian peace talks are set to resume in Geneva Thursday, the Pentagon said the U.S.-led coalition against Islamic State has expanded its role by airdropping local ground forces behind enemy lines near the IS-held town of Tabqa in northern Syria. Stephen Zunis, University of San Francisco analyst, said this is a departure from their previous role of train and advise.
Now, not only do we have combat-ready forces that are much closer to the actual conflict, you're having just this kind of support of inserting troops in ISIS-held territory and other actions, which definitely seem to indicate that the United States is upping its direct participation in the conflict.
Meanwhile, the Syrian Observatory of Human Rights said coalition airstrikes killed and wounded dozens in Tabqa and another town closer to Raqqa earlier this week. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson hosting a gathering of members of the Global Coalition to Defeat Islamic State. Wednesday called for safe zones for refugees as a next phase in the fight against the IS insurgency.
While a more defined course of action in Syria is still coming together, I can say the United States will increase our pressure on ISIS and al-Qaeda and will work to establish interim zones of stability through ceasefires to allow refugees to go home.
Tillerson did not indicate where the zones would be located or how they would work. Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte Thursday said he's been told by China it is not building anything on the disputed Scarborough Shoal in the South China Sea.
I was informed that they're not going to build anything sa Panatag out of respect for our friendship.
China's foreign ministry said reports that it was building a monitoring station on the shoal were not true. Both countries have claims to the shoal. China's construction work in the vital waterway has caused alarm in Southeast Asia and in the U.S. Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, who has exchanged verbal barbs with European officials, warned Wednesday of the safety of Westerners in the region could be in peril. He did not elaborate, but added that his country cannot be pushed and shoved around, its honor cannot be toyed with, its ministers ousted. European officials have denied Turkish officials access to rallies in Europe for a Turkish referendum, granting Mr. Erdogan sweeping new powers. South Korea raised the sunken 6,800-ton ferry Seoul from waters off the country's southwest coast nearly 3 years after it capsized and sank, killing more than 300. An investigation will seek answers to explain the cause of that sinking. Zimbabwe's opposition is demanding presidential elections next year be conducted by an independent commission set up by the UN and African Union. It said it has no confidence in the country's state-appointed electoral commission. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Thursday, March 23rd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Zimbabwe opposition parties demand an internationally run 2018 elections.
The political parties have made a fundamental decision and demand that ZEC must disband and it must be dismantled and it must be replaced by a UN-run, a SADC-run, or an AU-run election management body.
Douglas Wanzora is the Secretary General of Zimbabwe's main opposition party, Movement for Democratic Change. We'll also talk with MDC leader and former Prime Minister Morgan Tsvangirai. South Sudan's government accuses rebels of abducting three oil workers and killing a police officer. And Kenya's Electoral Commission cancels an order for a digital voter system.
We are actually working to make sure that nothing stops us from giving Kenyans the election they are waiting for on the 8th of August. And I want to confirm to the country that we are within our timelines and we shall give this country a free, fair and credible election.
Wafula Chibukati is the chairman of Kenya's Electoral Commission. Nigeria's Senate demands the resignation of the country's Controller General of Customs and Service. We will take you inside a Nigerian hospital maternity ward, and a Kenya-based podcast is breaking down misconceptions about sex. Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Opposition parties in Zimbabwe say they have no confidence in the country's electoral commission and are calling for an international body to run the 2018 elections. Sebastian Mofu covered a protest yesterday about the demands and reports from Harare.
Opposition parties, led by former Prime Minister Morgan Tsvangirai, held a rally of about 500 people Wednesday in Harare, at which they said the next election is heading for a dispute unless the Zimbabwe Electoral Commission steps aside. The rally follows the Electoral Commission's request to President Robert Mugabe's government to buy biometric voter registration equipment in preparation for Zimbabwe's 2018 elections. The opposition says the move is unconstitutional. Opposition supporters marched to the commission's offices to present a petition singing on their way. Douglas Wanzora, Secretary General of the main opposition party, Movement for Democratic Change, spoke to VOA.
The political parties have made a fundamental decision and demand that ZEC must disband and it must be dismantled and it must be replaced by a UN-run, a SADC-run, or an AU-run election management body. Previous in this country, in 1988 happened because the ZEC has failed the test of impartiality and independence. ZEC in the first place must be independent. The moment it ceases to be independent, it becomes unconstitutional. They cannot argue that they are constitutional and then act unconstitutionally. So it has ceased to be constitutional.
The electoral body has been meeting with all political parties in Zimbabwe. But Tuesday, ZEC chairwoman Rita Makarau said that is not working.
We accept fair criticism. Yes, balanced and fair criticism we have always welcomed. Abuse, we say no to abuse by any body, political parties or any other stakeholder. And because we are beginning to feel that our engagements are misunderstood, we believe it is time for ZEC to go back to the drawing board and see how best we can engage with you. This platform is not working, according to ZEC. We called you to dialogue, but you do not want to dialogue with us in good faith.
Makarau had not been happy with a media article quoting the opposition parties as criticizing the commission for asking the central government to take some of its procurement duties. The opposition parties argue the government was composed of the ruling party, which is a player in Zimbabwe's election. On Wednesday, the commission could not be reached for comment as it only allowed state-owned media into its offices when the opposition petition was presented. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
Former Zimbabwe Prime Minister Morgan Tsvangirai and his former Finance Minister Tendai Biti were among opposition members who participated in Wednesday's march in the capital Harare, calling for the disbandment of the state-appointed electoral commission. Blessing Zulu of VOA Zimbabwe program reports from Washington.
Former Prime Minister Morgan Tsvangirai was among those marching, singing, and demanding accountability from the country's electoral commission despite heavy police presence. Efforts to derail Wednesday's march proved unsuccessful as opposition parties put on a force of unity as they demanded the disbandment of the Zimbabwe Electoral Commission, which they declared lacked court, impartiality, and independence, close quote. Addressing the crowd, Tsvangirai said he would not allow the government to steal yet another election.
Every time we go to election, it is a dispute. Why should we have a character of an election which is violent and which is always dependent on cohesion and intimidation?
Tsvangirai, who is undergoing treatment for cancer, but assured Zimbabweans he is doing fine, contends he won the 2008 elections, though he did not assume office.
The opposition has not lost the election. The opposition in 2008 won an election. You all know the MDC victory in 2008. It's confirmed by Mugabe, by Mandu, and we won an election. So we have not lost an election. What we have not achieved is transfer of power.
Zimbabwe's elections have been marred by violence against opponents of President Robert Mugabe, as well as intimidation and alleged fraud, including the stuffing of the electoral roll with phantom voters, including names of long deceased people and children too young to vote. In preparation for the upcoming 2018 election, opposition parties, which number more than 54, have resolved to form a coalition to defeat ZANU-PF and President Mugabe. Among the biggest champions for this is former finance minister and leader of the People's Democratic Party, Tendai Biti, who also attended the protest.
The message we are sending to ZANU-PF, to Robert Mugabe, to his wife, to their children, to their rats, to their mice, is that we are coming for them.
The voter registration has been a contested issue between Zimbabwe's opposition and the ruling ZANU-PF, as many believe the government manipulated the voters' roll so as to boost its numbers. Tuesday's march is an effort by the opposition groups to ensure transparency and fairness in the upcoming elections. Reporting for VOA Zimbabwe Service, I'm Blessing Zulu in Washington.
Kenya's Electoral Commission has cancelled a contract with a European digital security company to supply Kenya with an integrated election management system. As Mohammed Yusuf reports from Nairobi, politicians and observers fear the electoral body may now be unable to meet the deadlines to hold the general election.
With less than 5 months until the general election, Kenya's Independent Electoral and Boundaries Commission has faced a setback. Tuesday, the commission notified Gemalto, a software and digital security company, it was cancelling a contract for an integrated electoral system to combine voter registration, voter identification, and the transmission of results electronically. The commission cited a lack of funds due to defending itself from court challenges. Despite the setback, commission chairman Wafula Chebukati says the panel will beat its deadline and deliver a credible election.
We actually working to make sure that nothing stops us from giving Kenyans the election they are waiting for on the 8th of August. And I want to confirm to the country that we are within our timelines and we shall give this country a free, fair and credible election.
Kenyan lawmakers passed a controversial electoral law in December, allowing the commission to identify and transmit results manually. The head of the Electoral Law and Governance Institute in Africa, Felix Odhiambo, says the only thing that can save the country from violence is the electronic voting system.
If they don't procure this technology, it means that the country will fall on the so-called manual backup system with catastrophic consequences. We will have a repeat of 2013 elections with all its flaws. We will have over 100% turnout in certain areas, and it will spell doom for the credibility of the electoral process in the country.
In 2013 general election, most of the electronic equipment collapsed during election day. The opposition disputed the presidential results and lost to the Supreme Court. Odhiambo knows the only way out of the political crisis is for the political leaders to negotiate some agreement so that the election can be held on time.
Well, the only way out of it is through political negotiation and political settlement and political consensus. There is no second way to it. And that would entail, for example, fast-tracking the procurement process of the technology.
The opposition has accused the government of trying to rig the election by allowing the electoral body to use the manual system. The electoral body has yet to clean up the voter register. A Kenyan court has thrown out an offer to a Dubai-based firm to print ballot papers due to procedural errors. The postponement of the August 8th poll will require a Kenyan referendum. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Thursday, March 23rd. Daybreak Africa time is 16 minutes past the hour. South Sudan's government says rebels allied to former First Vice President Riek Machar killed a policeman and abducted three oil workers on Sunday in the Paluk oil fields of the country's former Upper Nile state. A rebel military spokesman confirms his group abducted the oil workers, but says they did so because profits from oil sales were going straight into the pockets of certain individuals rather than benefiting the South Sudanese people. Wake Simon Wudu reports from Juba.
South Sudan's Information Minister Michael Makwe says the four oil workers, including a Pakistani, were abducted at Gumri oil fields of northern Upper Nile State after rebels infiltrated the fields.
They intercepted four of them. One of them was a soldier, one was a driver, and the other two were technicians. This is the intention of the rebels. They want to tell the people that they are capable of shutting down the oil field. As long as this is the second time, I think we will not allow the threat to happen.
Makwe says the oil workers and a policeman were abducted while the workers were checking on operations in the oil wells. It marks the second time this month that rebels have kidnapped oil workers from oil fields in this area. A week and a half ago, rebels abducted two Indian oil workers from the Adar oil fields in northern Upper Nile State. The two workers are still being held captive at an unknown location. Lieutenant Colonel Paul Lam Gabriel, the SPLAIO deputy military spokesman, confirms SPLAIO forces abducted the workers but defended the action.
We don't really encourage these oil workers to continue doing or drilling the oil, because we know it is going always to private pocket and purchasing of ammunition instead of helping the citizens. So the soldiers decided to apprehend them and overtake them.
Yesterday, South Sudan Petroleum Minister Ezekiel Lul Gatkwoth and a team of senior military officials visited the oil fields in northern Upper Nile State to try to reassure oil workers that the Juba government will protect them. Gatkwoth says he was ordered by President Salva Kiir to visit the oil fields and tell oil workers the government is taking measures to prevent similar abductions. Gatkwoth tried to reassure oil workers in Paluk about their safety.
The president has instructed all the forces, the army, the national security, the police, to provide maximum security protection for all the workers. From today onward, this one is not going to happen again. We will make sure that even if it is one person going out for the normal operations in the field, they will be escorted.
Gatkwoth appealed to both South Sudanese and foreign oil workers to cooperate with the government and continue their work. He says government is working to see that the abductees are released safely, but insists Juba will not negotiate with the abductors.
We are working to get them released unconditionally. We don't want to negotiate with terrorists, and we will not succumb to them demanding ransom like $1 million. We will not pay a single penny to get them released. They must be released unconditionally.
South Sudan currently pumps at least 130,000 barrels of oil per day. That is down from about 180,000 barrels per day before the outbreak of fighting in December 2013 and 306,000 barrels a day before the oil shut down in January 2012. For VOA News, I am Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
Nigeria's Senate has demanded the resignation of the Controller General of the Customs Service, Hamid Ibrahim Ali, who had been accused by the parliament of being unfit to lead the government agency. The senators also called on President Muhammadu Buhari to fire the embattled head of the Customs Service. The senators excused Mr. Ali from the hearing and asked him to return yesterday, Wednesday, this time insisting that he wears his uniform to the hearing. But Mr. Ali refused to do so. VOA's Peter Clottis spoke with Senator Buka Ibrahim about the disagreement.
Well, this deliberation started last week, and as far as I'm concerned, it's a very simple matter. But it has now been aggravated by the stubbornness of the chairman of the customs by declaring that he will never, ever wear any uniform, that he was a military man before, he has worn uniform before, and it is their tradition or law or whatever, convention or whatever, that they cannot use uniform twice. But this has been belied by quite a number of other appointments earlier, like Hanania and others who are in the military and who have reached the position of major generals. And yet when they retired and they were given other jobs with uniform, they still wore uniform and they never complained. So this is really an ordinarily simple matter being made serious and aggravated by the stubbornness, I believe, of the chairman of the customs, Colonel retired Ali.
Some people are saying that what has his uniform got to do with his competence to do the job, and that it is the Senate that should be blamed for this tension existing between the chairman of the customs and the Senate.
I agree with that assertion, but the fact of the matter is the Controller General of Customs is a rank, and every rank has its own uniform. So if, for example, tomorrow all the customs officers refuse to wear uniform, they're just like those of us bloody civilians. What differentiates them from anybody else? So it may not be a very fundamental issue, but I think convention and tradition demands that there is some uniformity in what we're doing. How can you have a customs director general who is always in Agbada? All his other officers are in uniform. And it is a rank. It's not a political appointment. We have not asked the minister who is supervising customs to put uniform. His is a rank. And ordinarily, in fact, he's not even supposed to be in that position at all because he's already 63, we have been told. And he has worked for more than 35 years. And this position he was given was a rank controller general. So in the first place, he shouldn't have been even appointed at all. I think the presidency did not do their homework.
Some people are saying because of his competence and his ability to fight corruption, that is why the president appointed him, because of the promises he made to Nigerians to fight corruption, and that asking the president to fire him literally undermines his fight to curb corruption, of which the Senate has promised to back the president.
Is he the only Nigerian who told to fight corruption? And we have 170 million people. Are you saying that he's the only one who can assist the president to fight corruption? Anytime an appointment is given, they should check some basic things so that we don't get into this kind of embarrassing situation of somebody who ought not to have been appointed in that position, being appointed, and now running into problems. There are many, 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 many uncountable number of Nigerians who can help Mr. President fight corruption. I have been in service all my life, from permanent secretary to state commissioner to governor 10 years, senator now getting to 12 years. Nobody has ever found anything wrong with my services all my life. She's not the only Nigerian who can do that job.
Buka Ibrahim is a Nigerian senator. He spoke with VOA's Peter Clotty from the capital, Abuja. Nigeria has one of the world's worst rates of maternal mortality. 58,000 Nigerian women died from pregnancy complications in 2015. Health workers at a hospital in northern Kaduna State are trying to improve maternal health. Chika Udwa gives us an inside look at the hospital's maternity ward.
Of Dansoho Memorial Hospital in the state of Kaduna, Nigeria. Most of the women have been referred here from primary health care centers. Radia Ahmed Rufai is about to deliver her first child, but she has developed preeclampsia, a complication during pregnancy that comes with a sudden rise of blood pressure. She has not been taking any medication for it.
She was referred from another hospital to this place with nothing to show that she was having those treatments. So it was here we found that she had high blood pressure.
This is Aisha Suleiman's day-old child. During the delivery, she experienced postpartum hemorrhaging. Fortunately, she was able to get a blood transfusion at the hospital. Many women aren't so lucky. Postpartum hemorrhage is a common cause of death for pregnant women in Nigeria.
the common problems affecting pregnant women in Kaduna State. One is postpartum hemorrhage. Secondly is pre-eclampsia as a result of early marriage. Girls get married at earlier age, and you can see them physically, they are okay, but internally, the organs are not well developed.
Hajia Mohammed is about to deliver twins, but one of them is in a dangerous bottom-down position known as breech. She will need a cesarean section.
Most of our women, number one, don't go for antenatal, and we only see them when there's complication.
Health workers who examine Radia confirm she cannot have a vaginal delivery. Her pelvis is too tight, the baby is too distressed. The medical staff prepares for C-sections. This hospital has a high success rate for the procedure. The day is nearly over. Here, women recover after delivery. Hajia Mohammed's healthy twin babies rest in the arms of their grandmothers. Chika Odua for VOA News, Kaduna, Nigeria.
A Kenya-based podcast hosted by two outspoken women is breaking down misconceptions about sex and claiming the media space for women to talk about the subject. Their hope is that the podcast will help women and young girls embrace and talk openly about their sexuality. Rayel Ombua reports from Nairobi.
All right. Oh, what nice. Are we talking about today?
Sexual health.
Ooh, what is sexual health?
Not even that. I'll just tell you why I wanted to. Why
Nini Washera and Karen Lucas are known as the sex queens of Nairobi. In a rather conservative country, they co-host a popular podcast called The Spread. The project is aimed at opening dialogue about sexuality, providing information on sexuality to people of all ages, focusing specifically on the youth. The platform kicked off in 2015 after Lucas and co-presenter Washera noted that no one was having conversations with the youth about sex. There was a platform on the continent, and in Kenya specifically, for a sexuality-based talk show.
It's the way we were raised, and it has a lot to do with religion and the religious beliefs that are pushed upon us and being told by our elders that certain things are wrong. But I think it's changing. I think there's a new wave and a new generation of people who are a lot more open. And if we can sort of spearhead that in Kenya, then we're very happy to do that. But it's about unlearning all of the things that we've been told are bad or taboo.
A wide range of topics are discussed on the show, from sexual health, body image, pornography, and the dangers associated with sex and sexual abuse, to HIV and sexually transmitted diseases.
There's many things that can be avoided. Teenage pregnancy, the spread of and rise of HIV amongst our children, sexual abuse. If we're having conversations with our children about sex and sexuality, then all of these things can be avoided or can be reduced in our country.
29-year-old Kathy Sonia is an ardent listener. Growing up, she struggled with her sexual identity. She had no one to talk to about it.
A lot of us are raised to believe that sex is not all more of a private issue. It never comes across to our parents talk to us about sex. That never happens. And so as kids, we grow up believing that that's just a taboo.
She says the show has helped her understand her sexuality. The Kenya Film and Classification Board is the government agency mandated to regulate the creation, broadcasting and distribution of films in the country. The Kenya Information and Communications Act empowers this agency to promote national values and morality. Its CEO Ezekiel Mutua says podcast produced in Kenya falls under the board's mandate. He says he supports the spread but insists that morality should be maintained. As long as the podcast does not promote homosexuality, he is fine with it. Rael Ombor for VOA News, Nairobi.
And briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Judges at the International Criminal Court on Wednesday sentenced former Congolese Vice President Jean-Pierre Bemba to an additional year in prison and fined him $324,000 for bribing witnesses. And that's it for this Thursday, March 23rd edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Bedford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, along with our engineer Jimmy Cook, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing you a lovely day.
Are you suffering from heartache? No problem. We've got the cure for you. The African beat can soothe your heartache with its awesome tunes from the African continent. So join me, David Vandy, Mondays through Fridays at 0900 and 2000 Universal Time for a healing journey. I guarantee it.